I'm going to call the meeting to order of the Senate Committee on Transportation this March the 2nd, 2005. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome you this afternoon. I'm going to change the order of business just a little bit. We're going to take the public hearing on Senate Bill 842 first, and I'm going to ask Judith to give us a little information on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate Bill 842 imposes a fee on the retail sale of studded tires or on the installation of studs onto tires. We have received a potential revenue impact on the measure, and Senate Bill 842 does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Senator Deckert is on his way. This is his bill. We'll wait just a few minutes on him, so we'll stand at ease.
Well, we can trash him in the room as well as out of the room.
Well, you could. You could. And if he doesn't get here soon, we'll let you do that.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the Senate Transportation Committee. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 842. It's one that I have never introduced, but I've always thought at least a little bit about, because I will tell you one anecdotal story that just reminds me on about a once a week or once every 4 days. My neighbor just consistently and never travels out of the valley, consistently puts on set of tires, and so I hear these tires, and it's every November they go on, and every March or April they come off, given the state deadlines on set of tires. And to me, that's the very issue that brings this bill before you. Is I sat down and thought at the beginning of the session, there's got to be some way, given that we know the damage that those do to the roads, and we do know that there is at least some damage done by those tires, there's got to be some way and some cost accountability for the state and some state interest here in doing something. And I know states like, I believe it's Michigan and Montana, that have just banned set of tires, and I don't think that's the approach the state could take, because we have, even those are snowy states, I just think it's a safety issue, especially when you get over on one side of the mountains or in an area where you're going to have to travel on roads that are icy and snowy, or up in Senator Metzger's neck of the woods in Welch's. So for me, it came down to, well, then how do you think creatively about this and work with a lot of the constituencies that are really, really interested in this issue to, A, perhaps provide an incentive, and I'm very willing to look geographically at this, because I really do believe it's that population centers that folks like myself and others that live in areas that don't receive snow or very rarely receive snow. Whether you do it the way we prescribed here, which is maybe some very nominal fee that would be attached to when I go out and put them on, just so at least there's a cognitive thought process that, $10. It's not obviously going to be too high of a fee, but it does help, A, offset some of the cost of repairing the roads, but also you have that thought of, well, I'm putting on tires here, and I should think about that a little bit. Or, and I would be at the will of the chair and of this committee willing to go at another way of an incentive to move to the studless tires, and do it in that manner. And maybe that $10 fee gets you there too if you do it at the old studded tires that obviously are less attractive than to the buyer. So, Madam Chair, that's really where I come at this. So you have my written testimony before you. You have the $11 million that's spent every year fixing studded tire damage, according to the ODOT study, and that this is just hopefully a creative way of getting at a new way of providing an incentive. It's a bill that I haven't seen in this form. Most of my seen just banned set of tires. In talking to the vice chair of this committee, at least we began a process of thinking how might we creatively get at this without affecting folks that really do need the safety of the studded tires, and I want to be extremely sensitive to that issue.
So you really wanted to bring this forward so the conversation would start.
Exactly, Madam Chair. I appreciate you allowing those of us who are interested in this a few minutes to just begin that conversation of how might we get at this, and at the direction of the chair and the committee, I'm willing to be as creative as necessary to perhaps find something that could get you're never going to get 100% buy-in, but might get a lot of buy-in from folks east of the Cascade, west of the Cascades, looking for a creative solution. But I do think if you walk out here, you'll hear them, and those are the folks that I think at least we need to jog a little bit of how badly you need it, given the amount of times that you spend in the snow.
Questions of Senator Deckard? All right. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll take you in alphabetical order. Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I yield my time to Senator Westland.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Senator Ben Westland, Central Oregon. I was on my way to saving the Northern Hemisphere when I just most fleetingly heard an absolutely scurrilous rumor. I know it can't possibly be true, that there was a suggestion that possibly we tax studded tires. So I immediately, deeming that studded tires, and I mean this part seriously, studded tires next to seatbelts are without question our single best winter safety device in Central and Eastern Oregon, thought I should lend my word of caution and concern about any regulation or taxing, I don't care, fee, call it what you will, adding an additional cost to this very significant safety device in Central and Eastern Oregon. Where Senator Ferrioli and I come from, these are not a luxury. These are truly a significant safety device. And you might think I digress from the subject when I start bragging on the Central Oregon being the second largest carrot for seed producing area in the world, and we produce mint oil, Madras mint oil. It is the standard by which all other mint oils are priced and judged. These are two of the finest agricultural commodities in the world. And the reason they are is that Central Oregon has the highest temperature beta in all of the 11 western states. In other words, our temperature varies are more extreme. We get warmer in the day and colder at night. Ergo, we melt the snow and the accumulated moisture during the daytime, and then that freezes up at night. So when all of us, I mean, my wife, Senator Ferrioli's wife, we start off in the morning with, you know, our most precious possessions, our children in tow, to go to school. I'm not sure Bend would actually function on many mornings because it's just a sheet of glare ice. And I understand there's some controversy about whether studded tires do damage. I just point to the many legislators over the many years, as I bet you I can guess Senator Ferrioli has on his car right now, and I have on mine, and I may not be too far wrong guessing that Senator Whitsett has studs on his. I don't see rutted grooves in our basement parking lot, and I don't think it's ever been repaved. For that, I will turn the rest of my time over to Senator Ferrioli and just add that this is not a luxury device where we come from. This is a significant winter safety driving.
Madam Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Ted Ferrioli. I live in John Day, Oregon. All I can do at this point would be to echo and perhaps expand on some of the testimony that you've heard from Senator Westland. I appreciate the fact that folks want to start this conversation, but let me assure you this conversation is as perennial as the daffodils in spring. This bill is a chestnut that is pulled out of the ashes of previous legislative sessions every single session. And we look at it, we turn it over, we knock it on the desktop, and we discard it because it's a bad piece of legislation. And it is, in fact, an issue of the lack of understanding between rural areas and urban areas. Madam Chairman, I live at 3,500 feet. Last week, I went to Burns area to participate in a Lincoln Day dinner celebration. And when my wife and I got in the car at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it was a blue sky day. and we went over the passes and over Star Ridge and down across the Seneca area and through the valleys and over the next range of mountains and down into the Burns area, and arrived there safely. During the course of the evening, the temperature dropped, it snowed, and when we went back home, we went back on icy and snow conditions. And thank the Lord and bless Schwab, Madam Chairman, for the delivery of a good, solid, highly usable steel-studded tire that conveys us safely around those corners where, Madam Chairman, there are no guardrails. And you may be 2.5 hours from a hospital, and even by life flight, it's a chancy issue if you go off the road that you'll survive that trip to the bottom of the canyon. Madam Chairman, it is a safety issue. And so I sort of look to the Oregon State Police in this regard. When I drive back and forth over the pass to John Day, often in snowy conditions, there's a little funny sign on the road. And it blinks on and off, and it says, traction devices required. Snow tires or studs or chains. Mm-hmm. And those, I think, can be further clarified. If you go out and look at the vehicles that the Oregon State Police uses in Eastern Oregon, you know what you'll find on the wheels? Studded tires. And these are professional drivers that spend their lives behind the wheels making all of us safe. And their judgment is, when they're given the choice between high traction tires or chains, they choose steel studs. And they do that because they've been proven to be a lot more safe in conveying people. I would just suggest to you that if one collision occurs because these traction devices aren't available, or they're priced out of people's reach, or they're regulated in some way, that the $11 million that's a known quantity for the wear and tear on our roads and highways from studded tires is incalculably compared to the cost of the resulting collision or the damage that might result from that, including fatalities. So I would just suggest to you, Madam Chairman, we've had this discussion many, many times before, rightly concluding that once the issue is aired, like old socks, they can be discarded. And I hope that's what we're going to talk about doing with this bill. It should be discarded. One other thing, Madam Chairman, and this is just an issue that's procedural. Senator Westland referred to this as a tax. This is a revenue-raising measure. It will be referred, I understand, to go where all bad little bills go to die, and that's the Ways and Means Committee. And that means, Madam Chairman, that I think it does involve revenue. We know that the cost is $11 million. I don't know that we have an estimate of what this will raise. But unless there's a connection between the cost raised by a fee and the services provided, it's called a tax, and taxes originate in the other chamber. So I would just raise the procedural question. This quacks like a duck, Madam Chairman, and it walks like a duck. It looks like a tax. I would suggest to you that it is a revenue-raising measure. It doesn't belong in the Senate. And, Madam Chairman, for my money, we've had a wonderful opportunity to discuss the issue and air it, and I hope you will send this little bill to oblivion where it richly deserves to go. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Questions? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for your graciousness and the opportunity to appear with my colleague from Bend, Oregon.
That is always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Cross everyone has to bear once in a while. Thanks, guys.
John Jackley, ODOT. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley, the Executive Officer for the Highway Division at ODOT. The department does not have a position on the bill. We do have a couple of observations that we wanted to share with the committee. One is about damage and one is about repair costs. Repair of ruts is necessary because driving, not only because driving on the roads is unpleasant, but because there are some obvious safety hazards. When ruts reach a certain depth, water pools up, it increases the opportunity for splash and spray, which decreases visibility, and you also have the potential for hydroplaning. And then when we do have to fix ruts, motorists are inconvenienced through lane closures and delays associated with the repair project. Now, thanks to the 1997 legislature, there are some alternatives. Those tires do provide good traction, making them as safe as tires with studs. The second issue is repair costs. We estimate that about $11 million a year is spent repairing damage on state, county, and city roads. This doesn't take care of all the damage to the highway system, but it allows us to collectively to deal with a portion of the problem. So in summary, there is damage to the roads caused by ruts. It can be significant and expensive, and that there are some alternatives available as well. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and happy to answer any questions.
You would stand behind the estimated $11 million damage to the roads?
Yes, it's approximately.
Also, just to address the procedural issue, it says on your written testimony that it will provide additional revenue to the state highway fund, which, of course, would not be a tax.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is that the bill would raise money. It would be collected by the Department of Revenue and then deposited into the state highway fund.
State highway fund.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Other questions? Yes, Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Jackley, thank you for your testimony. Do you know when was the last time there was an empirical study done, performed on the damage caused by studded tires in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we did a study in December 2000 that did an analysis of the pavement wear and tear and the cost of mitigation. I'd be glad to share that again with the committee, if you wish.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Messer.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jackley, I see our safety guru, Mr. Costales, is not here today, so I don't know how much of that arena that you're able to wade through. You heard Senator Farioli and also Senator Westland talk about safety issues. In the interim, the Joint Interim Committee on Transportation looked at this issue again of the chestnut, as Senator Farioli referred to it, and had a lot of folks together to look at how we might deal with this issue. And the packet, part of that packet is with each of the members here today. And one of those referred to a Washington State Department of Transportation study, similar to other studies we have seen, that while safety, as the Senator Farioli was mentioning, can certainly be a factor with studs in certain conditions, that the majority of conditions, where it's either dry or wet pavement, that stopping distances are actually much longer with studs and much more of a safety hazard. I mean, have you been part of that research and understanding the difference between safety on dry and wet highways for studs versus because of the fact that they have a tendency to hydroplane and also not be able to have as much pavement contact?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, there are safety issues regarding how you look at stud versus non-studded tires. I don't have that data with me, but I'd be glad to get it to you right away.
I think that would be helpful, Madam Chair, because in all the studies, it demonstrates that in the normal driving conditions like this today, the stopping distances are greater.
Great.
With studded tires. So it's not exactly a catch-all question. The other one I'd like to ask, too, Madam Chair, if I could, is that it was also pointed out in the study, and I think Senator Deckert mentioned it. We talk about the snowy, cold conditions, and I know we all have a concern about that. But if you look at places, I don't know if you've been to rural Michigan or Illinois or Wisconsin, I think they're rather cold there, and they totally ban use of studded tires there. And I just wonder why their drivers are so much better than our drivers in cold weather. I mean, do you have any, because apparently that's not a problem there.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, our studded tire studies do look at experiences in other states, and I'd be glad to follow up on you with it. I don't have that data here, but we can get it for you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're very welcome. I would suggest you also look at Alaska. There is a tire that's being used there, and it is not a studded tire, and they say that it is working quite well there. So thank you very much,
Madam Chair,
today for your testimony. Mark Nelson.
She's so short.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, and I'm representing Les Schwab Tire Centers before you today. I am testifying in opposition to House Bill 842. We appreciate the difficult task that you face in the Transportation Committee in trying to deal with key transportation issues. We disagree, however, that placing a tax on studded tires is a necessary component of that approach. As you might know, Les Schwab places a great importance on providing its customers with the ability to choose the tire that best suits their driving conditions. Les Schwab will sell tires. We'll sell tires whether they're studded tires or studless tires. So it's not an issue about selling tires. Regardless of this tax. But this tax will push customers to select a tire they personally believe is not safe. And that causes us great concern. We believe that the customer should have a choice to choose that tire, whether it's a studded tire or a studless tire or some other type of tire that best fits their driving conditions and their concern with safety. Providing that consumer choice is a central factor in considering the changes in the studded tire laws. The customer, we believe, not necessarily the legislature or the Department of Transportation, really is the one that is going to decide what fits their safety issues. I want to talk about three areas in dealing with the area dealing with studded tires. First is studded tires provide enhanced safety, and you've heard some of that testimony already, and I'll come back to you with some data. The data supporting the road damage in Oregon associated with studded tire use, we believe, is inconclusive and, more importantly, out of date, and I want to address Senator Whitsitt's question here very shortly. And then we think there is a fundamental issue of fairness that we want to address. Studded snow tires, as a part of Les Schwab's strong commitment to motors, are part of Les Schwab's commitment to motor safety. Studies show that studded snow tires provide a safe alternative for winter driving. And I can provide this study to you as well, but there was a Finnish National Road Administration study concluded that drivers using studded tires had a lower relative risk on ice and snow-packed roads than drivers using studless winter tires. And let me just read from that finding. The findings of the study indicate that all the alternatives concerning reduced road salting and the reduced use of studded tires would lead to an increase in the number of accidents. Reducing the level of salting by 50% would lead to 6%, and I'm skipping forward. Reducing the use of studded tires by 50% would increase such accidents in the winter season by 10%. The greatest effect on bodily injury accidents would occur in the scenario of an 80% reduced salting and less than 20% of passenger cars fitted with studded tires. And it's a very long study, and it takes 9 different scenarios and shows you what happens in each level of each scenario. And again, on all of these studies, there are conditions I want to emphasize, both positive and negative, that are different than Oregon. So I think each one needs to be taken, including ours, with a grain of salt, so to speak. The most recent study report on studded tires was issued in 2004 by the state of Alaska. The results of this study found that studded tires provide a savings in travel time and reduce vehicle accidents. Now, I've provided you a copy of that study, and it's fairly voluminous. But as you walk through, we've only talked about the cost of studded tires to roads. What the Alaska study takes all of the cost, all of the economic cost, all the other kinds of costs related to the cost of the tire. They actually have a tax up there on all tires. They have a tax on heavy studded tires, which we don't have here in Oregon. We have the lightweight. So there are different variables, but they have touched upon all of the costs, including the most important, which was the traffic accidents. And they stated, in summary, the Alaska School of Engineering, and this was who did the study, concluded savings from avoided crashes are the most substantial impact and benefits the broadest range of groups, including state government, vehicle owners, passengers, and insurance companies. So we would say that as if you look at cost, you cannot just isolate the impact on the road, that you need to look at all costs to the consumers. And we think that's very important. The there are certain people and certain vehicles that have difficulty using chains, for example. For example, some of our senior citizen customers want the security of studded tires and are not physically able to install chains. At the same time, some cars can't use chains, and such as Ford Explorers, Tauruses, some Chevrolets, and some Volvos cannot use chains. So chains are not an alternative for many parts or part of our populations. The evolving technology may someday make studded tires obsolete. And again, as I indicated, Les Schwab will sell the tires. The issue is the safety of our customers. Some tires that are on the market now, I think the chair was referring to one, is a Blizzak. It's a very good tire, using state-of-the-art technology to improve. It's a snow tire. We sell those tires, and we think they are a good option for some customers. However, there is no other type of winter tire that has a proven record of studded tire. I'll talk just briefly about the data. My understanding is there has not been an in-field study of the lightweight studs ever in this state. And we go all the way back, I believe the year is 1972, there was an in-field study of the impact of the heavy studs in that year. Every subsequent study has been an extrapolation of that base data. We have never gone out and taken a look at the lightweight studs in the field. I want to emphasize that, as to the impact of the lightweight studs. Now, if I'm wrong, I'm sure the department will correct me, but that's my understanding, that we've never had. We have asked and have talked about in the interim the need to go out and take a look, as Alaska did, at the full range of costs, not just damage to the roads, the social costs, the physical costs, the accidents, you actually drive a little faster with studs than you do without studs, and time savings, as the Alaska study has done, to really look at this issue in its totality, not just in terms of the damage. Finally, I think there's the issue of fairness. The proposal before you today would charge consumers who purchase or install studded tires an extra $40 for a set of four tires. We agree it's a tax. It's nearly equivalent to what we're charging for a motor vehicle registration. Many of the consumers who purchase studded tires are from Central and Eastern Oregon or travel there frequently, and that's what makes the difficulty of saying, well, we're going to ban them in Western Oregon, but we'll allow them in Eastern Oregon, because we have Oregonians that go back and forth all the time, including many of your colleagues. We just believe an extra $40 tax would cause undue hardship on those, particularly with fixed incomes and those with lower incomes. Oregon should work to understand the impacts of lighter weight studded tires before passing a tax on these products. We believe Oregon citizens deserve to choose the tire that provides the most safety without being forced to pay a tax. If they have to pay a tax, we believe you will force Oregonians to make a choice that is less safe for them in many instances. And we would like you to consider their needs in weighing this legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question, Senator Rickey.
Thank you, Chair Berger, Mr. Nelson. I thought your discussion of the empirical evidence or lack thereof of the studded tires is interesting. I was in Southern California recently, and in the freeway between Oxnard, California, and Los Angeles, the ruts in the freeway look real similar to those between Salem and Portland. And that's one of the things that prompted my question. Would you also discuss the difference in the traction characteristics of snow tires on packed snow and on ice, particularly wet ice, as compared to studded tires?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's a good question. And Senator Metzger had gleaned some information from previous studies. I think the studies do vary. The studies we have or that we've looked to show that you have almost equal stopping time on rain-soaked highways. So I wanted to respond to that. But we can go back and look at those studies as well. As I believe Senator Westland has indicated, and I think this is really truly the difference between Wisconsin and Michigan is eastern Oregon is just as Senator Westland says, and as you know, it warms up during the day. It melts that snow. It comes right back and just freezes it, makes it a solid sheet of ice. And that's where the studs are so much more effective than anything else. As it relates to packed snow, I think there may be some data in the Alaska study I can bring back to you. It's the real concern here in eastern Oregon is the ice.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson, on your testimony about the cost, in all fairness, I mean, every time we have a fee on something, inevitably there's the paragraph that it's going to hurt people because they can't afford it and the world ends for them, you know, and so we all feel very sorry about that and we don't talk about the issue anymore. But I want to talk a little bit about that issue. Do you know about what an average, I realize you got 13, 14, 15, 16, but, you know, an average 15-inch car at Les Schwab, for example. What is the cost of a studded tire range? You know, what would be the average cost of outfit yourself a studded tire?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, you're going to get me in big trouble with my client. I can't give you the tow cost. I can tell you they run about $20, $15 to $25 above an average set of tires. I'm going to guess, based upon the last time I bought tires, I would guess that would be in the 200 plus range.
Okay.
But they do vary substantially in cost depending upon the brand.
Sure.
and your studless tires as well. So
the reason, Madam Chair, the reason I want to relate that to the $10 fee to have the choice to still use studded tires. So I think part of the thing, and I think Senator Decker's been very thoughtful on this, is, you know, trying to incent behavior, but recognize those, for example, who go to and fro the mountain, you know, make that choice. They can do that still, but recognize the wear and tear there. But if we're looking at the financial impact of, say, an additional $40 for that set of tires for the studs, you know, the difference between what I drive, my wife and I have lived at Mount Hood for 18 years, and she's a nurse at St. Vincent Hospital, drives all the way from Mount Hood to St. Vincent every day, and I would drive to Portland or Salem. We've never had studs on either of our cars, and we live in the mountain, and we've always got there as long as anybody else, or if we didn't, it was so bad that nothing was going to help you on the highway, you better just stay home or do something else. But the difference is that we have the all-weather tire that we buy at Les Schwab. I'll put another plug-in for your client. They do a great job in Sandy. But how is that $40 a hardship? Because what's implied in that is that they have to own two sets of tires. So while I'm paying $250 for my set of four, the person who's using studs has to buy $250 plus the fee for one set of tires and take them off and buy another $250 set of tires to run the rest of the time. So they're spending $500. So it, to me, that $40 is a lot cheaper than having to have two full sets of tires. And that's why, so if I'm talking about hardship for the poor, I think it's a hardship to require people to have two sets of tires, and I would definitely rather have that all-weather tire.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Senator Metzger, your point is well taken. I just believe that people are in different driving conditions. They have different fears of driving on ice and driving on snow. That $40 is going to stop someone's daughter, someone's grandmother, from putting those studs on when they truly feel that's what makes them most safe. And again, as I say, we sell all those tires. It's just an issue that we have customers that simply won't or don't feel safe on anything else but the studded tires.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much
you.
For your testimony. I see Representative Beyer and Representative Hunt in the back, and I wonder if you might both come up to the table together. And on deck and last is going to be Glenn Stonebrink. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Terry Beyer, and I represent Springfield. This is an interesting subject. During the March 10th of 04 Interim Transportation Committee meeting, I was given the assignment to do a work group on the use of the trends in the use of studded tires and ways to mitigate and prevent damage to the highways. And I think it was given to me because I didn't have a real strong bias on this issue either way. It was an interesting process. We met twice and reached agreement on 4 points. During this process, and a lot of this information, this is a real brief synopsis. You have the report that we did. The use of studded tires contributes to pavement damage, and there continues to be a demand for studded tires even with the availability of winter tires with comparable safety characteristics. Past legislatures have taken steps to reduce road damage, which include requiring the lightweight studs, shortening the season where studded tires are allowed, and allowing the use of studless winter tires. So these are just some of the efforts the legislature has passed in the past. So, and the importance of timely repair of stud cause damage to prevent higher road costs or repair costs. And we were unable to reach consensus on about four issues, which is surprising that it would only be four issues, I guess, but the extent of the cost of the damage, not a real agreement on what that is. The safety benefits, which you're hearing a little bit today, too, on a set of tires. And the safety drawbacks to pavement rutting, and what those were, and the trends in the use of studded tires. We haven't really got a real good feel for that yet. We discussed a number of options to deal with it, and the group couldn't reach an agreement on recommendations to pursue either disincentives for the use of studded tires or incentives for the use of studless traction tires. The industry members supported maintaining the consumer's choice of tires, and the federal, state, and local government road agency representatives thought that steps previously taken in Oregon were making a difference, but not nearly to the degree that were anticipated or needed. Most of the committee members supported the general user pay concept, but we could not reach a consensus on the need for a studded tire fee. Although we could not reach that consensus, it was considered the fee on purchase was considered the best of the banned fee options because of the ease of administration and enforcement. Today, I'm here to voice my personal support for House Bill 842, not the committee's or the interim committee's support. Clearly, damage is occurring on our road system from the use of studded tires. ODOT estimates that they spend $7.8 million, and this is, in an effort not to confuse you, this is just on the state system. When we start using the term 11 million versus the 7.8, that's on the local roads as opposed to the state highway system. And at that level, the state is not keeping, that's to repair the damage, and at that level the state is not keeping up with the annual damage. And they estimate to keep up with the annual damage would be an additional $1.8 million. And a one-time $48 million investment is necessary to repair, to finance the repair of all ruts greater than 3/4 inches. Currently, all highway users are bearing the cost of repairing the damage caused by 16% of Oregon drivers that use the studded tires. 842 is a start at restoring the fairness to highway financing and moves us closer to what historically has been a transportation user pay system. Charging a studded tire fee may also encourage motorists to switch to a non-studded traction tire, which have been proven to be just as safe in most winter driving conditions. And a couple little things that I was listening to. During our discussion, I mentioned collecting crash data because I know that they were saying they were using this information in the Alaska study. ODOT wasn't, and the state police didn't think this was really a big benefit because it was just one more thing in a bunch of data that would be collected. So you wouldn't really gain a lot from it. People do tend to drive faster with studs, and that combination does increase the road damage. So that's the other thing you need to keep in mind. And this bill, while it does put a fee on studded tires, it does not take away choice. And that's important to note, that we're not talking about a ban on studded tires. People still have the option of using other types of devices or not, and they can also use the studded tires. It's just a matter of picking up more of the cost of the repair. So thank you. Any questions?
Any questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I would just like to acknowledge the work of Representative Beyer, because it was I who gave her that assignment. Because everybody else kind of sat back and said, not me, Mr. Chair. And Representative Beyer did step forward in a difficult environment. I think did just an excellent job of really sorting through the issues, and I appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
And I thank you for taking the time today to come and testify. Representative Dave Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. Just really wanted to support the words of my colleague here. I think both Representative Beyer and I, like members of this committee, pride ourselves on not coming to issues with a lot of preconceptions and a lot of biases and really focusing on solutions. I see, based on having read the study, listened to testimony during the interim, and done more reading more recently, I see the bill before us as very much a solution-oriented bill that, again, as Representative Beyer said, does not focus on an extreme solution like a ban, but focuses on a very middle ground. And I think looks at a fee level that is very much on the low end of what the range may be. If you look at the estimates of what the range of damage may be, many of them have multiples of the fee proposed in this bill as the actual damage. I think it really looks at the low end in a very conservative manner. I would encourage us not to end this session focused on another study. I think there are so many issues we study, so many state resources we spend on studies. We know that the result of a study would say that studded tires have an impact on damaging roads. We don't know exactly what it would say that range is. But from my perspective, the fee proposed in this bill would certainly be at the low end of that range, and a study might well demonstrate a higher fee. But rather than waste 2 years, go through the continued damage to the roads, which are tremendously prevalent. As Senator Metzger and I drive home, we deal with major studded tire ruts every day, heading up Interstate 5 and 205. There clearly is an impact. This is an opportunity to take a very middle ground approach that does not ban. That actually proposes a fee. And I think it's really very consistent. As I read the Oregon Constitution, the component related to cost responsibility, which the voters have very clearly affirmed, of cost responsibility in that case between passenger vehicles and trucks, I think is very much applicable here. We have affirmed cost responsibility as something that we value. And it's time for those of us who choose to purchase studded tires, which have a damaging impact to the roads, to pay at least something toward the repair of those roads that is being caused. And so I encourage you to keep forward on this bill and applaud you bringing this bill to a hearing today.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize to the panels that came before me. I had other things I had to take care of this afternoon. But in the work group, was there a discussion of some type of division of looking at the damage? From my understanding, that there's more damage done in the west side of the Cascades in the valley as compared to the east side. And I've heard the arguments that for those who are in more winter conditions, that they really rely on studded tires. And I'm wondering if there's been any, was there any discussions as to looking at maybe having some type of, lack of better terms, maybe a ban in areas where there's more damage done and where maybe the need isn't there, but the perception there is compared to allowing in other areas? Or is it just based on the discussion reached the point that we should not look at banding at all, but instead should look at just the cost of the repairs that are necessary.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Prasansky, there were discussions on that line in the committee. Again, no consensus was reached. When you start dealing with splitting the state, it gets very complicated. There was a bill last session that did split the state into different regions. State police were not enthusiastic about any type of a split type of a program. The reason, and we have, Dave, Representative Hunt and I have a bill that's very similar. I think it's probably almost the same bill that we're dropping today in the House. And the reason we're going this way is because, you know, we think something needs to be done now, and that this was, again, what I had said earlier is the easiest way to go through this. The best, as I was saying, is that the ease of administration and enforcement would be the best way, is just at point of sale and collection with a fee to the dealers for handling this. And that's the main reason that we've gone this direction.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Yes. Senator Wick?
I think it's a good example, Representative Byron Hunt, of the urban-rural divide that we talk about in Oregon. 80% of the people in Oregon live within 20 miles of the Willamette River. There are only, you know, 2/15 of us live on the east side by our districts. And much of that area is 3,000 to 5,000 feet in elevation. And as Mr. Nelson testified, we get a lot of icy conditions. I'm a retired veterinarian that used to drive 40,000, 50,000 miles a year. Studded tires were very important to my survival. Not that I couldn't have survived without them, but it's very important. And I'm not a professional driver, but I mean, I've driven a million miles. I'm pretty comfortable driving. When you take young people or your wife and you put them out on the road, early in the morning going to school or going to work, and in the evening after the sun goes down coming back, those conditions are icy much of the time. And it's not uncommon that from the time that you leave home, you're on ice, and then it starts to get a little wet on top of the ice. It gets extremely slick. The other snow tires are pretty good in packed snow, but on the ice, there's nothing that will take place of those studded tires. There isn't any question. That was just my point.
Thank you. Just a quick comment again, Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt. Again, that's one of the reasons that this is the direction we've gone, is with a fee on studded tires, because it certainly does not take away a person's choice. And if they certainly feel safer with those studded tires, then we feel that they should have them.
If I could also respond, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I look at those who are probably the worst abusers of studded tires, I think they are probably, frankly, constituents of ours on the west side. Those who actually don't need studded tires for very many days of the year, as your constituents may. And so, and they're actually causing a huge amount of damage and currently paying nothing toward fixing that damage. So this is not, certainly I see a divide in terms of the number of days that would be used for studded tires. And if there were a ban, I would see a very geographic, a negative impact to that. But in terms of a fee, I see that this would be paid for by studded tire users all across Oregon, many of whom are my constituents, who are causing a lot of damage to roads on the west side.
Sure. Follow up.
Chair Berger, Representative Hunt. The question then that comes to mind, if you know, the 80% of the people that are damaging the highways are your constituents that live on this side of the mountains, and why would you inflict a fee on the 20% or the 15% of us that live on the other side of the mountain that really needs them?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the fee would be on anyone who purchases a set of tires. If 80% of those tires are purchased on the west side, 80% of the fees would be paid by people on the west side.
The question addresses the need for them. On one side of the mountain, we really do need them. On the other side of the mountain, there's arguably a lot of people that use them that don't need them. But the fee or the tax would apply to both sides of the mountains, obviously.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, and that I think you can make a very clear case that there is damage being caused on roads all across Oregon, east and west, and that the fee would apply to anyone purchasing those tires in order to at least begin to repair that damage. Certainly wouldn't cover the total cost of repairing the damage caused by a set of tires, but at least would begin to recoup those costs.
We see very few wrecks on rural roads caused by a set of tires.
All right. Thank you very much for being here today. Last witness will be Glenn Stonebrink. And then next I'm going to go back to the top of the agenda, to the Metropolitan Planning Organizations. The MPO is going to spend about 15 minutes giving us a presentation about who they are. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. To those folks, and of course I represent ranchers all over the state of Oregon, not just eastern Oregon, and not just western Oregon, but to those folks in eastern Oregon, studded tires and icy roads are a way of life. I spent 13 years in Wallowa County, used studded tires every winter. The rest of my life I've been here in the Willamette Valley. And as most of you know, if you live in Willamette Valley, you may get a couple days a year that you wished you had studded tires. It's more of a nuisance or an inconvenience, and oftentimes you don't have to get on the highway if it's just for those couple days. But in eastern Oregon, it might be 4 months out of the year. And a lot of the time, the vehicles that are, at least the ranchers that I represent, a lot of the time they put the studded tires on, they never get on an interstate highway. They may get on a county blacktop road with their pickup or their car, but a lot of it's on private roads or on county gravel roads that they use these. So they'd still be paying the $40, but they wouldn't be doing any damage whatsoever, or they don't do any damage whatsoever. Now, I'm not saying that they don't. Some of them don't get on the highway. At least once a year during the winter, I used to get on the highway and drive for the Willamette Valley. So that one time of the year, I would. But the rest of the time, my driving was in and around the farm, and I needed them. But if you go up over Ladd Canyon between LeGrand and Baker, or Meacham between LeGrand and Pendleton, and you get up there with the knobs of ice or about 3 inches in diameter, and you're just sitting there kind of bouncing, I don't care how slow you're going, without studded tires or tire chains, but tire chains aren't near as good as a studded tire, you're in danger. You really are. Presently, I have my daughter usually goes to Eastern Oregon with my two grandchildren in the wintertime for Christmas, and I can't imagine her going over those passes without studded tires. But if it comes to $40, do I put them on or do I not put them on? Now, if you pass this law, probably Grandpa will foot the bill and I'll pay for it. But there are going to be people that will make that choice. And I don't think that's, in a sense, it's a discrimination against the east side versus west side. Now, there was comments here made about Minnesota and other upper Midwest states banning studded tires. I spend a fair amount of time in Minnesota. And that's right. There nobody has studded tires. But if you look at Minnesota, it's pretty flat. You don't. When they talk about a hill in Oregon, it's just a dip in the road. But they use chemicals. And for the longest time, it was a salt base. And you can see a lot of cars driving around there in pickups that are like the ones that are over on the Oregon coast. They're all rusted out. They now have a chemical that they claim doesn't do that. It's not a salt base. But what happens, you can drive on the main roads pretty well. They keep them graded, and the chemicals keeps the snow melted. But I just talked to my wife just a week or so ago, left the main highway and drove in to where the house is, and one of those little dips put her in the ditch, and she just had, you know, the regular tires. Without studded tires, you are going to be in difficulty. As I left the office a few moments back, I was talking with an employee of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. He lives in La Grande. He's over here on special assignment. And he said, oh my goodness, whatever you do, don't take away my studded tires. State employee. When I was with U.S. Department of Agriculture, all of my district directors that drove in Eastern Oregon, we paid for their studded tires. It was no question about it. And money wasn't the issue. It was a safety thing. But when you get down to it, the bottom line is that by placing a tax or a fee on studded tires, there will be customers that will choose between the $40 and their safety. And I don't think that's what we want to get into. As the gentleman from Les Schwab stated, that the alternative tires do not work as well as studded tires. And it seems that perhaps there is a lack of studies as to what really is the cost now, because I know there some people have tried the alternative tires and they've gone to plastic studs. The last study was in 2000. As well as looking at some of the other studies and variables before we decide to put this on, which I think is a biased tax against the folks in Eastern Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'd urge you to vote no on this bill, however.
Any questions? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the Metropolitan Planning Organization waiting until we can get past studded tires. We had a number of legislators that needed to testify, so we needed to get them through the bill. So you're welcome to come now and make your presentation.
Technology. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Betty Griffiths, and I'm on the Corvallis City Council and also a representative on CAMPO, which you'll find out what that is, but it's the Corvallis Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. Some of you probably know, and some of you probably don't know.
Excuse me just 1 minute.
Yes.
I failed to close the public hearing.
Oh.
And I need to do that because that's the way it's supposed to be, and I'm going to close the Senate public hearing on Senate Bill 842.
Chucky darn, I was going to sneak a studded tire thing in there.
Included in the studded tire.
No, okay.
All right.
Great. We're probably not going to be near as colorful as those gentlemen and lady. But thank you very much for giving of us your time on your busy agenda to provide you a briefing on metropolitan planning organizations. We're not asking for anything today. We're just here to provide you information and answer your questions. And we want you to know that even though there's probably only four of us left, there were a number of us who were here, and some of them had to leave for other appointments. But we do represent a large number of constituents, over 2 million Oregonians, for instance, live within metropolitan planning organization regions, and we are growing. I'm a constituent of one of the newest metropolitan planning organizations. For those of you who don't know, an MPO is a federally designated area that is designated by the government as a regional transportation policy board or area, and it's for metropolitan areas of more than $50,000 population under the federal census. And there are MPOs in Oregon reaching from Portland to Medford and over to Bend. So we cover an awful lot of the state. Our role is to develop 20-year regional transportation plans and to carry out that role. Part of what we're working on is trying to figure out how to work together to come up with consensus, to work towards an overall goal for all of us for maintenance, preservation, modernization, and also with an emphasis on multimodal. How do we deal with all of the connections of all of the transportation networks from air to roads rail? They're all important, and we need to balance those. It was interesting in terms of multimodal. I was on the way here, and really we have multimodal because I passed a couple of horsemen on Church Street. I was a little surprised at that, and then I got cut off by a sports car. So there's the wide range there of transportation methods. We're supportive of Connect Oregon, although we're not here to testify on that. And we're supportive of long-term multi-session strategies and ways to tie projects together, to tie the roads and the bridges and the rail together in a comprehensive network. I forgot to introduce the next two speakers. Michael Quilty will be, who is from Rogue Valley MPO, and Dan Clem from Salem Kaiser MPO, and Rex Burkholder from the Metropolitan MPO. We don't have any solutions today. We were asked by the House Committee what solutions we had. We don't come to you asking for anything or giving you solutions. We come to let you know who we are and the fact that we are going to be working together to work on solutions and ideas that will come forward to you in the future.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, committee members, hello. I'm Michael Quilty. I'm a city councilman in Central Point, and I'm also the chair of the Rogue Valley Metropolitan Planning Organization in Southern Oregon. And I'd like to tell the chair, my sister started teaching the first kindergarten classes in North Bend, Oregon. So I'm very familiar with your area, and Sunset Bay is probably my favorite place in all of Oregon.
Beautiful.
The MPOs in Oregon, our federal charter mandates that we look at transport from a multimodal aspect. So we're not here just about private automobile ability to get around on the state freeways. We're not here to talk about whether or not we need more bike lanes or whether or not we need more freight moved on rails or on barges on the Columbia. Every single one of those things is something that we're required to look at, and all of those things taken together gives us the infrastructure to help us drive our economy forward into the future. In the last 15 years, we've seen a huge growth in the metropolitan areas inside the state of Oregon, from Bend seeing almost 150% growth since the early 90s to a low of 12% in the Corvallis area. Every one of the major urban areas in Oregon has grown significantly, and in growing, we have taken and helped provide the engine that moves the economy in Oregon forward, because businesses locate where there are people to employ. MPOs bridge local needs with state and federal transportation dollars. We do local planning, and we operate what we've planned locally with a global outlook. And in staying competitive, we look at moving freight in our area so that the commodities that our businesses make and the goods that our people want to buy are available in the marketplace. With our continued growth and increased congestion, if we fail to pay attention to upgrading our infrastructure and maintaining that which the Oregon legislature has been so good to help pay for with the OTIA bills recently, we look at falling ever further behind, because we'll spend more time waiting in traffic and trucks will be able to make fewer deliveries every day when they're out on their routes, because it just takes longer to get where we're going. And that will cost us real dollars that will never be recovered. If you want to talk about delay, is our state continues to grow. The amount of time that it takes to travel from one end to the other of the state or from just across town will continue to get longer and longer. And if we do not grow the infrastructure that we move on, that congestion will cost us, again, money that we will never be able to put back into the economy, because it's wasted just sitting on the road someplace. We face a funding challenge, and if we don't take and address maintenance and preservation, we'll find that the cost of neglecting maintenance and preservation will outstrip the cost of building the structures that we move on to start with. And if we want to take and look at falling behind, if we compare comparable revenues generated for transportation in Oregon versus our neighbors here in the West, Oregon has the smallest amount for equivalent amount of money generated by vehicles and gas taxes of any of the Western states, and that directly affects our ability to provide the infrastructure that our economy needs to run on. And with that, I'm going to let Dan talk to you a little bit about how we connect together.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Klim, City Councilor for the City of Salem. We've come together as MPOs to find commonality and provide support and advice to each other. The large area of Metro Salem, some of the new MPOs, we're finding that we have a lot in common as we look at what should Oregon's strategy be in terms of transportation and how it relates to economic well-being and viability. And we've listed some strategy items that are common to all of us in terms of investing in centers, in freight corridors, better streets, travel options, and for the special needs by tying all of the modes of transportation together. But in fact, we believe that over the long term, a multimodal program has got to account for, and we need to understand how we provide for the infrastructure for both rail, aviation, marine, and all of the items that are listed there, but then also that there's this problem of what do you do about the roads in between those things. The story I bring to you today is one not too far from here, and that is what we call McGilchrist Southeast. Here in Salem, from the Salem Airport, such the small airport that really doesn't have a carrier, we're trying to get a carrier here, and we've raised money locally, and we've gone and lobbied some of the major carriers, and if we're successful and we actually get an airport up and running here where we can bring in both people and freight, and it is an operating airport, but in fact not one that's moving a lot of those right now, we've got the opportunity here under proposed legislation and in plans that we're doing locally to really open the airport up for economic development. With the assistance of the governor and the legislature, we've got the Salem Regional Economic Center, which will open up 500 acres, provide 5,000 jobs in an area just south of the airport. One of the problems is we've got the economic development, we've got the airport development, we've got some spotty support, and it's great and tremendously appreciated. But one of the things that one of our challenges is now, how do we deal with connecting those? So we bring the commonality amongst all the MPOs of supporting all the modes of transportation. Multimodal truly needs a long-term and an all-interconnectivity across jurisdictions. This is not a rural versus urban issue. It's an area that affects what happens here in Salem in terms of McGilchrist will affect areas outside of the Salem city boundaries. So our regional MPOs are looking at how do we solve the whole region's issues in terms of multimodal? How do we get it off the rail? How do we get it across town so that the product can be sold? And also within Oregon, all of the MPOs will again meet tomorrow to find further commonalities as we try to leverage the best of both federal dollars and state dollars to move people and equipment for Oregon's economic health.
Yeah, that works. Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Rex Burkholder. I am an elected member of the Metro Council. It's a regional government, the only elected regional government in the country, actually. And one of our duties is to be the Metropolitan Plan Organization for the Portland metropolitan area. I'm going to talk a little bit about the range of needs that the various MPOs have. Let's call them opportunities and challenges that we have in the various MPOs. One thing is that under federal law and state law, we are required to adopt a 20-year regional transportation plan. So we're thinking about our kids and grandkids, what their world is going to be like, and will they have the transportation system they need to run their economies and maintain their communities the way that we like to have it today. So what you'll see are fairly large numbers, because we are looking looking at 20 years and trying to say, what do we have to plan for? First, one of the new MPOs that just this time around broke that 50,000-person barrier is the Bend MPO. One key thing about Bend is the largest western city without a transit system. That's a major issue for them, is when you're trying to talk about moving people, getting them to their jobs, you need an integrated approach between transit and roads. If you do it just roads, you end up with pretty much terminal congestion, and we see a lot of that happening in Bend. So we have, next one is Corvallis, which also is a new metropolitan planning organization, and they're still developing their 20-year plan. What they have so far, not the long-term needs, but they do show that in the short term they have $17 million for roads, and then about $3 million for the short-term transit investments in that. They do have a transit system. Eugene Springfield, which does, it's actually next level up in terms of metropolitan planning organizations, has more responsibilities because it has over 200,000 residents. They, as you see, the numbers there are quite a bit larger. It's a large urban area, lots of activity going on there. It needs both road as well as transit dollars. Now, one key issue is on funding is road projects all qualify for the state highway gas tax fund. They also receive a 90% federal match. If you are going for federal money, you can qualify for up to 90% of the dollars being spent on a project being paid by the federal government. Transit, it's a declining share, and it's down to about 50% now, which the federal government will share. But the other 50% comes from local revenues. There's very little state money, a little bit from the cigarette tax that's used for elderly and disabled transportation. All the rest has to come from a local fund. And last year, this body approved an increase in the bond in the revenue authority of the TriMet in the Portland area, which is going to help a lot. But again, it's raised locally; it doesn't come from the state level. Medford Ashland, which is a fairly large area that's spread out, has obviously a lot of road needs. It's a major freight connection in southern Oregon. It's where the freight heading to California has to travel through. And especially with the limitations on the railroads, there's some tunnels in the mountains that the railroads can't carry a double stack trailer through. And so a lot of those vehicles have to travel through this area on I-5 and then get broken up and repackaged and shipped into California here. Portland area, obviously you're going to have a big number. We're about 40% of the state's population, a lot of the economic activity. I'm just going to talk about one issue there, which is the bottlenecks. You have major transportation corridors north-south, I-5, and east-west, which is I-84 plus the Columbia River, and you have two main lines of the railroads from both those directions meeting right in Portland, right at the Columbia River. And it's a major issue we're working on. It's a number one project with the Oregon Transportation Commission right now, looking at Columbia River crossing. That's the road side. We also have the rail side for both freight and passenger. Major issues we're dealing with there. Salem-Keizer, where you're located today, and Mr. Clem discussed one of the issues there. That's one of a big pile of issues here. We're looking at a new bridge to connect across the Willamette River to the coast, as well as shortfalls of, or let's see, desired amounts of money. Let's not call it, there's opportunities, right, to look for more funding for both transit as well as roadways. Now, that's kind of the end of a brief visit to the larger urban areas of Oregon. And you can see they're very diverse in their size and in their needs, but they're similar in the sense that there is a need to, as someone has said before, to grow the pie. The pie is not big enough. If we keep dividing it smaller and smaller, everybody ends up with a smaller piece and not enough to actually do their job. What we'll do is stop there and answer any questions, and also we want to make sure you have your invitation there to the reception at 5:30, starting at 5:30 across the street at the Hallie Ford Museum. And also one other thing you have in front of you, which I forgot to mention, is that you do have a roster of the members of the MPO boards in front of you. It's made up of city and county representatives, elected representatives, as well as agency heads in the area. The local Department of Transportation manager will be on that board as well. And so it's a place where we sit down together and try to figure out these problems. And that's our role, really, is to help figure out these problems.
I really appreciate having you, and I'm going to have to ask the committee to hold off on questions. We have a number of other bills that we need to look at, or I'll have them here long past your reception. So perhaps they can go over and have some time with you on a 101. But thank you for sharing and letting us know who you are and what you're all about.
Yes, and we will be in touch and look forward to working with you. And
thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
And I'm going to change the agenda a little bit again. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 595. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate Bill 595 allows the Director of the Department of Transportation to temporarily suspend one or more motor carrier statutes during a time of emergency. Emergency, the reference there is under Chapter 401, which is any man-made or natural circumstance that is including but not limited to, for example, fire, explosion, flood, severe weather, drought, earthquake, volcanic activity, spills of oil and hazardous materials, that sort of thing. It does limit the length of time the statute may be suspended to 72 hours unless a general state of emergency is declared. We have a no revenue impact statement on the measure. We have not heard from fiscal. You have one additional document at your seat at the dais, and that was the Dash 1 amendments, which simply add an emergency clause. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your permission and the indulgence of the committee, could I invite a longtime colleague of mine from the helicopter industry to join me?
Absolutely.
Mr. Gibson?
Be our guest.
I'm going to make some very brief introductory remarks and then ask Mr. Gibson to share the substance of the bill with you. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from Senate District 16. This bill, Senate Bill 595, takes me back to a time in another life when I was a commercial helicopter pilot and commercial helicopter operator, and we fought fires all over the western United States. We used fuel trucks that went out into the field to follow the helicopters because without fuel you have grounded assets, and that's not a good situation in conflagration. So I'm very aware of the need to have fuel trucks and helicopters lined up in the same place at the same time. There's been a change in the federal law that prescribes duty limitations for trucks regardless of whether they're driving or not, and this bill sets out to address that problem. What the federal legislation didn't contemplate is that frequently it takes the truck a lot longer to get to the scene of a fire than it does the helicopter, and that often the truck sits all day, time now counted against the driver's duty limitation, and then the driver has to go for fuel at night because that's the only time when the driver can be away from the fuel truck and the helicopter operation. The result is paralyzed firefighting assets at fires, which is completely unacceptable and contravenes common sense. This bill fixes that situation by giving ODOT the ability to relax duty limitations in the event of conflagration or in times of emergency. And I understand that you have also been presented with an amendment that would specify an emergency clause. I think for any of us that live in Oregon to be in shirt sleeves in February with 60-degree days and looking up into the mountains and seeing the paucity of snowpack should send chills through all of us that live in or around the forest. I've actually packed a house in anticipation of evacuation from forest fires twice. If there was ever a time and a need for an emergency clause, I would suggest to you that this is now. I anticipate, based on my experience, in fact, I grew up over in Central Oregon, that we're going to have a terrible forest fire season. And the fact that Mr. Gibson and his company are one of several that do specialty firefighting, we need to make them as available to fight conflagration as possible. And with that, I would ask Mr. Gibson to comment on the specifics of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm owner of Siskiyou Transportation. I'm manager of helicopter operations for Timberland Logging. And as usual, Senator Johnson pretty much covered the issue 110%, so I don't know how much that I can add. And I appreciate her time and effort on this this issue, but basically, as she stated, the problem that we run into in firefighting situations is when a fire breaks, we have no idea where the fire is going to be. Assets begin to be mobilized immediately, and timers is of the essence. When an aircraft is dispatched to a fire, specifically a helicopter, when that helicopter arrives on scene, it typically may have 1 to 2 hours worth of firefighting capability. Certain aircraft, there may be a little bit more prior to it needing to stop for refueling. There are times when the aircraft has to wait for the fuel truck anyway. However, once the fuel truck arrives, the aircraft is refueled and it's operational again. That lies the problem. Once the fuel truck arrives, aircraft's refueled, the fuel truck driver generally has another two to as much as 6 hours in certain circumstances, basically to sit and, for lack of a better term, lounge around. All of our fuel truck drivers do, in fact, have lounge chairs on the fuel trucks, and that's purely from the course that we want them to be as comfortable as possible, and they really have absolutely no duties while waiting for that aircraft to return. Under the current hours of service regulations that went into effect in January of 2004, the hours of service for those fuel truck drivers are increasingly limited. Under the old rules, those periods that those drivers took theoretically as off-duty, they could be logged as off-duty, therefore they would not count against the hours of service maximum for those drivers on a daily basis. Under the new rules, the driver basically from the point which he starts his work day, whether he's driving or not, until a period 14 hours later, that driver is basically considered to have reached his maximum duty day after that 14-hour period. Regardless of whether the driver spent 6 or 8 hours off duty during the day, those hours still count towards that driver's duty day. What this, what Senate Bill 595 would do would allow the state of Oregon to take advantage of a part of the federal motor carrier safety regulations that would allow the suspension of those regulations during periods of an emergency. The issue we have is the emergency has to be an official declaration of an emergency. So what this bill would do would allow the Oregon Department of Transportation to declare that emergency only as it relates to the safety regulations. And basically, in that situation, the hours of service would no longer be an issue. This isn't only an issue of firefighting, although predominantly that's the problem at this point. There are other situations where ODOT could find this beneficial. One example would be the delivery of home heating fuel in winter months during snow and ice storms. And there are other examples. But so it is a needed clause. It is a needed bill, and I urge your support. Last summer, Senator Johnson, myself, Greg Del Ponte from ODOT, the Oregon representative from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and Bob Russell from OTA all met with the governor's office to try to see if we could come up with some sort of fix. At that point, the governor's office seemed supportive. My understanding is the governor's office has seen this bill, and they're okay with it. On the federal level, there is some legislation that I'm hoping to put forth. I'm the chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Helicopter Association International Trade Association, and we're trying to come up with a fix on the federal level. However, whether that happens or not, obviously, is going to be up in the air. So with that in mind, I urge your support of Senate Bill 595 and also urge your support of the amendment, as Senator Johnson mentioned. It's critical that that this be passed as soon as possible.
Thank you very much. Unlike Senator Johnson, I do not buy helicopters. So I have a very probably a 101 question. Do the fuel trucks, the people that actually bring the fuel to the site, do they work for your company?
Anytime we have a helicopter under contract to a firefighting agency, part of that requires us to provide a support crew or support module. In our case, we operate light aircraft, small aircraft. And each time we dispatch a helicopter, we dispatch a fuel truck that we own and a fuel truck driver driver who works for us. There may be times on large complex fires where fuel suppliers will provide fuel to the fire. Basically, what they're just doing is providing bulk fuel to resupply the fuel trucks that we supply directly for the aircraft.
And Madam Chair, I can say that was our experience too in the years that I was in the commercial helicopter business. The fuel truck drivers worked for us, and we owned the rolling stock.
All right. Senator Whitsett is recognized.
Chair Bridger, Breeder, would you address what effect the reduction of the available fixed wing fire retardant aircraft has had on the need for your helicopter work on fire suppression? From the basis of the fixed wing aircraft fuel at the airports and the helicopters fuel on site.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, that's an excellent point on both sides. Over the last year, I'm sure most of you are aware, there's been a major change in the availability of federal air tankers. Last year alone, the state of Oregon Department of Forestry, put on a number of additional helicopters to try to stop that gap in firefighting assets. And the big difference between those assets and helicopter assets is all of those air tankers are obviously operated out of an airport where fuel is supplied, in fact, at that airport. Helicopter operations generally, if you'll have a large complex fire — complex mean a large fire, possibly a number of fires all operated out of one helibase — you'll have a helibase with potentially 8, 10, 12 helicopters all at that same base, and that becomes your fueling point, where the aircraft are parked, briefings, etc. In addition to that, in the helicopter world, for example, we have a contract with the state of Oregon based in Klamath Falls where we provide initial attack helicopter services. In that situation, when a fire breaks, that helicopter goes wherever the fire is in that particular district, Klamath and Lake County, and the fuel truck follows along. So at that point, the fueling point could be a field, a driveway, a wide spot along the highway, wherever it may come up.
Follow up?
If you would indulge just a short anecdote, I don't know if you, you know this, but as in a previous incarnation, when I was financing my habit of going to college, I fought fire for the Forest Service. And in the mid-60s, we were on a fire on the Winter Rim. There was a fuel truck there, and it wasn't manned during the day. And the fire changed, the wind changed, and it blew under the fire truck, or under the fuel tanker. And then we had a conflagration that took off the whole side of the Winter Rim. But I think that the need for having someone on those trucks is very important. I mean, they may be sitting there in the lounge chair, but they actually are doing something. Thank you.
All right. Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, you didn't ask this question, but I am going to just follow on a little bit. Ever since I've been in the legislature and going back into my private sector career, I think one of the things that we need to work on as policymakers is to make sure that we have the right combination of assets, fixed wing, helicopter, and all the support vehicles that they need at every fire, with a minimum of red tape between the state and the feds. I think it is absolutely outrageous to show up at a helibase and see assets parked on the ground, because we're tangling over the red tape involved with who owns the fire, who's in control, and it's one of the things that I continue to urge this body to do. For us to have firefighting equipment available and watch the fire rage through our forest is madness. And so while I would support your view that fuel truck drivers need to be with their equipment at all times to respond to all of the vicissitudes of conflagration, I also want to say that I think we should constantly be vigilant of the red tape that stands in the way between the fire and the fire being put out.
Absolutely, Senator. You and I both know that you can put out a fire with a shovel when it's small enough, and when it's large enough, you can't put out a fire with a D6 tanker.
Amen.
Other questions for Mr. Gibson or Senator Johnson? Otherwise, I'm going to turn it over to Senator Metzger, who has...
Well, it's on a different topic, so I think maybe we'll just close out on this one first.
All right.
Just let Bob sit there.
All right. Well, you're going to let him get off easy. Senator Metzger had a question for you, Mr. Russell, but he says that he's going to decline.
Well, I don't want to decline, but I just don't want to confuse the issue.
Confuse the issue. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You stay right there, and I'm going to... I don't have any other people to do this. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 595.
Thank you. Mr. Russell, I wanted to ask a question, and it was time kind of wanted to wait because I knew your client would be coming up here. One question regarding the set of tire debate that we had earlier today, because of your experience with trucks. They're the biggest mass of trucks. They're very heavy. They're the fastest, hardest ones to stop, the most vulnerable, and could do the most damage. What do trucks do in terms of studs that pass over our mountain passes? Do they have studded tires on most big trucks?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association. Senator Metzger, I would like to thank you for asking me that question. heavy trucks are prohibited from using studs in Oregon. We are only allowed to use chains as traction devices, and so when we have to traverse our mountain passes, we put on chains.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank all of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 373. We'll let Judith get organized here.
Thank you, Madam Chair members. Senate Bill 373 allows eligible employees to request the Department of Transportation to use the employer's address instead of the employee's resident address on records maintained by the department. You have before you the -3 amendments and the hand-engrossed version of those that adds to the definition of eligible employee. If you look on your hand-engrossed version on page 2, starting on line 33, it then reads as an eligible employee, an employee who provides educational services to persons who are clients or patients of the Department of Human Services, who are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, or who are under the custody or supervision of the Department of Corrections, the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, a community corrections agency, the Oregon Youth Authority, or a juvenile department. As used in this paragraph, employee who provides educational services means a person who provides instruction or services related to the instruction of a subject usually taught in an elementary school, a secondary school, or a community college, or who provides special education and related services in other than a school setting. It also, you'll see, if you look on the hand-engrossed version, page 2A, it also adds as eligible employees those employees of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission who are inspectors, investigators, or regulatory managers. One deletion from eligible employees is, you'll see on line 40 there on page 2A, school district is deleted from... Strict school district employees are deleted from those eligible. And I want to mention one other item. We're actually expecting -4 amendments. These are the -3s. The addition that the -4 would add would be on page 2 under on line 32. Senator Prozanski had asked for a reference as to the reference for district attorney under statute, and the -4 amendments would include that reference clarifying who the district attorneys are that are eligible. We have received a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. And I'll call Tricia Smith and John Steubenbaum. Thank you. Well, I'm trying to get organized here. I'm not seeming to be as organized. That's all right. Come right on. Just start talking.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we're happy to be back with you and thank the chair for scheduling a work session on Senate Bill 373. Along with Mr. Steubenvall, we have produced the Dash 3 amendments, and I wanted to come today and answer any questions you may have about that amendment. As you may recall from the earlier hearing, the original bill was brought to you to cover and protect our members who are teachers and other educational professionals that are working in correctional institutions, Oregon Youth Authority facilities, the Oregon State Hospital, and also work for education service districts and provide special ed services in other than school settings, for example, in home services for early intervention programs. And the Dash 3 amendment was brought to you because the original bill was drafted too broadly and could be interpreted to include educators who were working in regular school settings, which was not our intent. We believe that this bill tightens the language to describe the employees that we're talking about, and the department, the Motor Vehicles Division, has asked that I put on the record some clarification because their folks there apparently have to write rules to allow this to happen, and they want to be sure that they're talking about the right folks. And so I've told them that I would put on the record that what we hope they will look for, in addition to the my understanding is employers have to provide certification to the department that these employees are indeed eligible for this, and we hope that they will be looking at where they work. This is for folks who do not work in schools. They work instead, as I said, at McLaren, Hillcrest, the state hospital, in at-risk facilities or in at-risk situations. And so we think that as they are trying to figure out who we're talking about in this bill, first look to the language, it's pretty clear to us. But secondly, we're talking about folks who are not working in standard school settings. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Tricia? John?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. John Steubenvall, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I really want to thank the committee and the proponents of this legislation for opening the door to some OLCC folks to get in into this legislation. We've kept the amendment as it relates to OLCC very narrow in nature. It would apply to three types of OLCC employees, and all three of those types are folks who deal directly with liquor license holders or patrons of bars and restaurants, and so do find themselves in difficult situations on a routine basis. We actually did the calculation this morning as far as how many what's the universe of OLCC employees that this would apply to, and the grand total is 63 OLCC employees would be eligible for this under the language in the Dash 3 amendments. So while the number is not great, 63 is not great in number, it's very important to those folks because they do find themselves in situations where they face threats, physical and verbal. I've talked to many of our folks, for example, about this proposed legislation, and one related story to me recently about an investigation. This is an OLCC investigator who's a party to an investigation with other law enforcement at this point, who has, upon being threatened by a particular license holder, talked with other law enforcement and was informed by the FBI that this particular license holder has ties to organized crime in other states. And so legislation like this, our folks' view, is very helpful because now clearly not a daily occurrence dealing with organized crime for OLCC folks, it certainly is not uncommon for our folks to find themselves in this situation. And so they view this as a very good personal safety measure, not only for themselves, but for members of their family. And so we certainly encourage the committee to adopt the Dash 3 amendments, and thank you for your consideration. Be happy to respond to questions.
Any questions for John?
I have one.
Yes, Senator Metzger.
Have you done any, for the OLCC, I'd be curious, have you done any analysis, say, over the last 10, 20 years of how many these individuals and the appointment of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission have had people stalk them at home or assault them or anything that this would help protect? Do we have any information on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, over the last 20 years, no, but I've done an on-the-fly survey here in recent days, getting ready, you know, gearing up for this hearing today. In addition to the person I've talked to here, I've talked to other staff who have been threatened verbally and physically. I've talked to another staff person who's had her car vandalized in one of our facilities. I've had another manager, a working manager, who was followed home from our office one evening. So do I have a good count? No. But I have some stories that certainly chilled my spine to some extent.
All right. Other questions? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 373, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 373. Senator Whitfield.
Madam Chair, I move the...
Senator Pazansky has a conceptual.
Okay. We do need to order, I think. If you want me to go first, I'll be glad.
That would be fine.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move a conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 373, and that would be found on the Hannah Gross copy of page of the dash threes on page 3, line 32, which is, starts off with a sub L, and it says a district attorney or deputy district attorney. My conceptual amendment is to add after district attorney the following phrase, as defined in ORS 131.005. And then it would continue as written for deputy district attorney.
All right. I want to do this right procedurally here. Do I need to adopt the conceptual amendment first before Senator Whitsett moves the dash threes?
You will, and you need to probably open it up for discussion as to the conceptual before we go to the next.
All right. All right. Senator Pazansky has presented a conceptual agreement amendment. Excuse me, and.
Madam Chair, members, the motion then before us is to add to Senate Bill 373, page 2 of the bill, line 32, will read, the motion will read, a district attorney as defined in ORS 131.005 or a deputy district attorney.
Is there any discussion on the conceptual amendment?
If not, I mean, basically it just defines as it requires under state the statutes who is covered under the term district attorney, and I want to make sure it's as broad as the statute provides currently and not limited to just the district attorney.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now I need to the motion by Senator Ritz.
Right.
Senator Ritz.
We need to vote on that one
by the clerk.
Yeah, motion's on the table.
All right, the motion's on the table. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Pazansky.
Aye.
Senator Stogg. Senator Whitson.
Aye.
Chair Berger.
Aye. All right. Now I move to Senator Whitson.
Correct.
Motion.
Declare the motion passes.
Okay. All right. I'll declare the motion passes. Now, Senator.
Chair Bridger, I move the -3 amendments dated February 28, as amended by the conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 373.
Senator Whitsett moves the -3 amendment stated February 28th as amended by the conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 373. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Pazansky?
Aye.
Senator Stahl? Senator Whitsett?
Aye.
Chair Berger?
Aye.
Motion passed. Mr. Berger, I move Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsett moves Senate Bill 373 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, just for the record, I just want to make sure that everyone understands, even though I'm part of a class that will benefit as to being able to use this as a city prosecutor, I just want to put that on the record, even though I don't think I have to, since it affects all people that are city prosecutors as well as attorney general and other people that cover them in the definition, but I won't put that on the record this time.
I appreciate the disclaimer. Thank you very much. All right. There's no further discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Bozanski?
Aye.
Senator Starr? Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Chair Bergeron?
Aye. All right. Senate Bill 373 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to carry the bill?
I'll carry it.
All right. Senator Bozanski, carry the bill. All right. Not sure about the next bill and our last one on the agenda. Is there someone here that is going to speak to the study that was done on U-turns? All right, then I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 685.
Judith? Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate Bill 685 requires the Department of Transportation to conduct a study regarding the feasibility of expanding the number of places where U-turns are permitted. As it turns out, the Department has already completed that study, and the study results are before you.
I'll call up John Jaffe from ODOT. Wait, just a minute. There's someone here for Senator Starr. Yes. Then you should come to the table first. Ken McDermott.
Thank you, Senator Chairman Verger, members of the committee. For the record, I am Ken McDermott, Legislative Assistant for Senator Charles Starr. Senate Bill 685, which is before you, is actually a reiteration of Senate Bill 663 from last session. I hope that bringing it back this time won't raise it to the level of old socks quite yet. The purpose of the bill was to simply be a placeholder until we did get this report. It did come back a little later than we anticipated. It came back in a positive manner, and we would like to go back to LC, get the amendments, reintroduce 663 from its original form from last session. And to clarify that for you, Oregon is different from all of the surrounding states in that when you go to make a U-turn in Oregon at a traffic signal with a left turn arrow, you can only do that if it is specifically allowed. There has to be a sign at the intersection which says you may do that. The surrounding states allow you to make the U-turn unless the sign says you can't. This has resulted in some confusion, not so much for native Oregonians, but for tourists coming through the state, for new residents coming from outside. I've mentioned this, and of course this is all sort of hearsay evidence, but many people said, oh yeah, I found that out the hard way. Uh-huh. And they tell me what the fine was that they paid. This began as a constituent issue, and so we intend to ask LC to draft some amendments because the report is, as I say, came back positive, and John Jackley, rather, from ODOT is here specifically to speak to the report they produced, and I'm open to any questions you might have.
All right. Any questions of Mr. McDermott? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Now I'll call John Jack from ODOT.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Jackley. I'm the Executive Officer of the Highway Division at ODOT. Appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. We did complete this study. It was transmitted yesterday. So It was a little late. We apologize for that. The bill directs us to conduct a study regarding the feasibility of expanding the number of places where U-turns are permitted. The study does that. We found, as part of our study, surveys of ODOT's regions and our local agencies, we found strong support for changing this law to make it consistent with the laws of other states. If we did have a new law, the study recommends that the burden be placed on the driver to decide if the U-turn can be made safely, because that would take the legal liability away from the local road authority. U-turns, the study found, would probably need to be prohibited at only a few intersections with known conflicts or places where there's safety or capacity issues involved. We did find that if the statute is revised, some level of review of all signalized intersections, that's kind of traffic talk for intersections that have lights, will be required to determine if there's safety or operational factors that would point to the need to prohibit it. The study found that the cost of implementing the new law would be somewhere between $900,000 and $1.5 million. The bulk of that cost would be the assessment of the signalized intersections. In preparing the report, by way of background, ODOT staff worked with the Oregon Traffic Control Device Committee, which consists of city and county traffic representatives, Federal Highway, Oregon State Police, a representative of the traffic engineering consulting engineering community, and ODOT. We hope that this report meets the requirements of the bill that's in front of you, and as the previous speaker said, it did have a positive finding and would lay the groundwork for making this kind of change. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that y'all might have.
I don't quite understand the difference there. And Mr. McDermott is talking about where it says no U-turn.
That's correct.
Rather than saying you can make a U-turn. So am I confused by that? Are you saying that with what you're doing, the way the study reads, it's like you would be saying when you can U-turn rather than when you cannot. Am I wrong in that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, maybe we should look at it this way. The bill itself says that ODOT would conduct a study regarding the feasibility of expanding the number of places where U-turns are permitted. Right now, they're only permitted, in essence, by default. If there's no sign that tells you that you can do a U-turn, then it's not permitted. What the report found was that there'd be good grounds and solid research for, in essence, turning it around the other way, that they would be permitted unless there were factors that would cause it to not be permitted.
Okay, what you're saying is if there's no sign telling you you can make a U-turn, then that means you cannot.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's
correct. Mr. McDermott is saying the sign would say no U-turn. So those are apples and oranges. Does the committee understand where I'm coming from?
Senator Prezansky.
My understanding is currently, our current law, you cannot make a U-turn unless it's designated, says you may make a U-turn.
Right.
And so what we're going to do, or what's considered, is basically changing that philosophy and that law, and you would automatically be able to make a U-turn unless there's a sign telling you that you cannot. And my understanding is the study basically was done that says that would be feasible or permissible based on their study.
Madam Chair, Senator Prezansky, that's correct.
Now, the only question I have is, did they have to signal that turn?
Yeah, right. Right.
Not if they have studded tires on.
Why is the cost so great in from the study?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a good question. I looked into that myself. First of all, between ODOT and the local jurisdictions, there's about 3,400 such signalized intersections in the state. We estimated that it would take about 1 hour per intersection to make that assessment at $50 an hour. And if you turn to page 9 of the study, you'll see a complete cost breakdown of where that $900,000 came to. It covers everything from looking at the poles that some of these signs would be on. It goes into structural changes. It looks at the field analyses and breaks all that down, and that's where the cost figure came from. Because we would want to make sure that, of course, safety would be paramount and that it would be safe to allow U-turns at those intersections.
Any questions? Well, my only comment is that it seems like every time we want to change something, the cost, whether it's the department or whether it's DMV, is just huge. Sometimes it's the computer program that has to be changed. I mean, it's just so expensive, it defies common sense. It seems to me there should be an easier, simpler, less expensive way to decide whether it's safe for me to make a U-turn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we would agree completely with your philosophy. Our traffic engineers do spend an awful lot of time looking at the safety considerations, though. In some cases, you might need to spend a little bit more money, because if you had a potential of making a U-turn and yet the oncoming traffic had a right turn light, you would want to make sure that either the signal timing worked right or there wasn't any overlap. So it does seem like an awful lot of money at first. But I think if you break it down to the number of structures and to the different safety considerations that are involved in that, that's the number that we came up with.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And Mr. McDermott, would you come back just to me clarify from my own mind exactly? You want to go back to the original bill of 663, is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, I may have introduced that confusion. When the bill was originally introduced, it would have changed current Oregon law. The consensus of the committee at that time was that there was a need to study and determine whether or not it was, first of all, safe, secondly, was it necessary and what the cost would be. And so we amended the bill to require the study.
Right.
Now that we have the study, we want to introduce amendments that will implement the study. And that implementation goes back to the original language of 663 from the last session.
All right. I wanted to clarify that. Could you tell me the cost of the study?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that offhand, but I can get it to you right away. I apologize for not having that at the tip of my tongue.
I see Joan Plank in the back. Do you know? All right, I would appreciate knowing what the study costs. All right, I think I'm clear on that. So I will close the public hearing.
When I saw the bill relating to U-turns, I thought it dealt with actions of the Legislative Assembly.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Which we do all the time.
Okay. All right. Committee, I've been asked to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 373. Judith?
Madam Chair, members, I did not realize that weeks ago, in fact, I got back the language that Senator Pozanski had asked me to submit for him way back on February 14th. We do have the Dash 2 amendments that do exactly what Senator Pozanski had moved in the conceptual, and that is on page 2 of the bill, line 32, before or insert as defined in ORS 131.005.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to make a motion to withdraw my conceptual amendment to Senate Bill 373.
All right. Are there any objections? No objections. So ordered.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion to adopt the dash twos to Senate Bill 373.
Senator Pruszynski moves to adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 373.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm going to have a little discussion on this as we close. I think this is an excellent idea and will keep us all out of the woodshed of legislative council after we walk out of this room.
All right. Do we need to call a vote?
Yes,
also,
we certainly do.
All right.
Adopt the amendment.
We will have the clerk call the roll.
Senator Messick.
Aye.
Senator Pruszynski.
Aye.
Senator Starr. Senator Whitson.
Aye.
Chair Vince Berger.
Aye.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make an motion at this time to send Senate Bill 373 as amended by the dash twos and the dash threes to the floor with the pass recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Senator Pruszynski has moved that the dash twos and the dash threes to Senate Bill 373 go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, clerk call the roll.
Senator Messick.
Aye.
Senator Pruszynski.
Aye.
Senator Starr. Senator
Whitson. Aye.
Chair Berger.
Aye. Senate Bill 373 passes with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Pruszynski will carry the bill.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, boy. I need to brush up on my color in English. I'm sorry, I'm thinking. Thinking about other things ahead rather than this committee. My mind just left the committee. If there's no other business to come before this body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.
Thank you.